Another big bank settles with regulators rather than going to court.
And in Europe, Greece plays for time. Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, August 15th. Coming up, we'll talk about a couple of big companies that can say a lot about what's going on in the economy. One is reporting some good earnings today, one not so good.
And major retailers, we're learning this morning, are joining the battle for your digital wallet. That's pretty interesting. We'll also talk about why TV shows are leaving California for greener pastures. It's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The stock price of Standard Chartered Bank rose sharply first thing this morning after the British bank settled with New York state regulators for $340 million. Standard Chartered was on the brink of going to court because of allegations that it hid thousands of financial transactions with Iran.
Instead, the bank settled without admitting any wrongdoing. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore joins us now with the details. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Heidi, I mean, $340 million does sound like a lot of money for any bank. Why did Standard Chartered want to do this?
Actually, most banks get through that by tea time. But it actually is a saving grace for Standard Chartered. HSBC was also facing money laundering charges. They set aside $700 million. And, you know, the New York State Department of Finance was threatening Standard Chartered with the loss of its banking license. So they were facing far greater penalties. This is kind of a win for them. But more often, just banks see a court date as really a settlement deadline.
Well, why would the regulators want to do this? I mean, if they had a strong enough case against Standard Chartered to get this kind of a settlement, why not just go to court and potentially get more?
Well, they're completely outgunned. I talked to Andrew Newton. He's a former compliance officer for HSBC, and he wrote a book, The Handbook of Ethics and Financial Services. Here's what he told me about it.
Pursuing one of these cases against an extremely well-resourced financial institution could take a long time. They will have banks and banks and banks of lawyers against your small team. It really isn't evenly matched.
And of course, Standard Chartered is still facing more angry regulators at the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. So their trial is by no means over, even if it's not in court.
So not out of the woods yet. They may have other charges to face down the road.
They definitely will.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Greece's current government took power in June, and since then, the world's been waiting for the specific plan to break the stalemate with its European creditors. Well, this morning, we may have a glimpse of it. The Financial Times says it got an early look at the plan Greece's prime minister will bring to the table next week with German and French leaders. For more context, the BBC's Mark Lowen is with us from Athens. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jeff.
The headline here is that Greece wants more time, what a surprise, to implement the austerity cuts, get their budget under control. We have heard that before. How are they pitching it this time?
Well, the report that the Financial Times seems to have got a copy of suggests that the Greek Prime Minister Antonis Samaras will present that Greece should have two extra years to reduce its deficit. And for that, it would need 20 billion euros extra. The big question is whether this is going to be accepted in Berlin and Paris. And that is pretty doubtful, I have to say, because the mood music from both of those capitals in the last few weeks has very much been that there will be no room for maneuver, that Greece must honor its commitments and stick to what it has signed up to.
This was supposed to be the Greek government that would be able to strike a deal with its European partners. Does this look like just more of the same old Greece?
Well, the Greek government that came into power after the election in June has said that it will stick to the austerity path ahead. The question is whether the government is going to be able to honour the promise it made to the electorate, which is to renegotiate some of the terms of the bailout. So that is why there is so much pressure on the Prime Minister when he does go to Berlin and Paris next week to try to get some kind of concessions from those capitals. If he doesn't, if he gets a slap in the face and comes back to Athens with nothing, then really there will be a very, very big backlash, I think, back here in Greece from people saying, look, you have not lived up to what you promised us. And then probably the social unrest will begin.
Great context from the BBC's Mark Lowen in Athens. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
The office supply chain Staples is looking at a stock price that's down 15% this morning.
Yikes.
After a weak earnings report, Jeff. I mean, sales were down 5.5% last quarter. In addition, we've got earnings from Target, which is actually flat compared with a year ago, profit of about $700 million, and they saw a sales uptick. For more on this, let's bring in Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He joins us now, as he does each Wednesday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Josh, let's start with Staples. What is behind this poor earnings report, and what does it mean for the economy, do you think?
You know, the Staples story is an interesting one. You look at the stock right now trading at almost nine-year lows. What we're really seeing here is a shift in priorities. You know, everyone's looking to cut back in from the corporate standpoint. And, you know, Staples, a lot of the spending there, it turns out it's a little bit more discretionary than what you would have thought. They're also having trouble selling software and computers, which are pretty high-margin products. So they had a disappointing earnings report, and it speaks volumes in terms of companies, corporations, businesses not spending the way we hoped that they would.
And what about Target? I mean, this is one of the big discount retailers reporting a flat profit.
Yeah, no, Target is the opposite of Staples. They've got traction, they've got foot traffic, they've got people using the website, and they're growing. They're opening up city Target stores in Chicago and Seattle. They're going into Canada this fall for the first time ever. And I think it's indicative of the fact that people are very price conscious. They want a bargain, but they don't necessarily want to walk into a Kmart or a Sears and feel the weight of that gloom, the linoleum floors, the fluorescent lighting. So I think Target gives them kind of a discount retailer with a little bit more cachet.
They want to feel like they're getting the better end of the deal.
They want to feel like they're getting the better end of the deal. They want the actual prices of things to be lower, but they want to buy nice things in a better atmosphere. And I think that's, you know, really consistent with this theme of people learning to do more with less.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Stock markets in Asia today closed down for the most part, down about 1% in Hong Kong. In Europe, mixed stock market results as we're headed toward the close in light of the Greek announcement. U.S. markets doing very little so far this morning. The U.S. government said this morning consumer prices were flat last month compared with the month of June, so inflation appears to be very much in check. Farm equipment maker Deere & Company, John Deere Tractors, right, missed expectations with its quarterly earnings report this morning. But this is interesting, Jeremy. Company says the drought actually could help its bottom line because farmers are going to want to upgrade to equipment with the latest technology.
Yeah, you want to see what you can do to make up for the drought with your equipment. Well, you know, Brazil has been a very bright spot in the global economy in recent years. It's been seeing high growth rates, but things are starting to slow down. And so today the government is launching a stimulus package of sorts. For more, let's bring in the BBC's Joao Felet. He is with us from Brasilia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so what exactly is the government of Brazil planning to do here to stimulate the economy?
Well, Brazil's government is set to launch a series of measures, hoping to inject up to $50 billion in the economy over the next 5 years. The first part of this plan includes privatizing about 14 kilometers of railways, roads. The government is also expecting to privatize ports, to bring energy costs down, to do some incentives for industry, some tax cuts. The main reason is that growth in Brazil is predicted to be under 2% this year, which would be the weakest performance since 2009, and also a sharp slowdown from an impressive 7.5% rise in 2010.
But you can't always have 7.5% growth. I mean, obviously the economy is going to slow down. Why do they feel pressure to do this kind of stimulus right now?
Well, the country has a very large population, a very large poor population, and the government argues that it needs to keep high growth rates in order to include these people. So the recent weak results have been attributed mainly to rising debt rates among the population and also the global downturn. So the government is acting with the tools it has, at least to keep it higher than 2%.
The BBC's Joao Felet in Brasilia. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Today, Australia's highest court ruled the government there can go ahead with plans to force tobacco companies to sell cigarettes with nothing but a plain package. No branding at all on them, just graphic warnings that say tobacco can kill you. So how tough is Australia compared with the rest of the world? Christopher Worth reports from London.
At this shop in central London, store owner Rina Patel stands in front of a wall of cigarettes.
Marlboro Lights, Marlboro Reds, Pall Mall, St. Moritz.
By 2015, small shops like this in the UK will have to keep tobacco products out of sight of customers, and Patel isn't happy about it.
No one's going to know that you actually sell the cigarettes. People don't want to ask. They'll come in, have a look. If you haven't got it on display, they'll just walk straight out.
It may be bad for sales, but it's exactly what anti-tobacco groups want. Gerard Hastings is the director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research. He says many countries have moved to control how cigarettes are advertised. For example, Brazil has the same graphic warning signs that you'll find in the U.S. Hastings also studied the potential of the kind of plain packaging laws Australia has just approved, and he thinks it's a good thing.
The design of the pack is not left to chance. It is carefully researched and very, very carefully designed in a number of different ways to make it as attractive as possible. It's been used by tobacco companies more and more energetically as other elements of their marketing have been removed.
And now that Australia has the first plain packaging law, he expects lots of other countries to follow. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan will be in Las Vegas today for a campaign fundraiser. Over the last few days, he's been barnstorming the country talking about the need for fiscal responsibility. Here he is yesterday in Des Moines.
President Obama has given us 4 years of trillion-dollar-plus deficits. He is making matters worse, and he is spending our children into a diminished future.
So does that message resonate with Americans? That's the first question we're asking in today's edition of Attitude Check, our weekly partnership with the polling firm Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so Frank, I mean, how much do Americans really care about the federal deficit?
If you say open-endedly, what's the most important problem facing the country, or how do you recommend that we fix the U.S. economy, relatively few people spontaneously mention the deficit as a major problem. But if you put the deficit in a list, which we recently did, and said, how much of a priority should all the following be for the next president, whoever that might be, the deficit popped right up there below creating jobs and stopping corruption in government is number three on the list. So I think in the back of their minds, Americans would agree with Paul Ryan, for example, that the deficit is a big issue, but it's not the thing that they think of first when they think about the economy.
Well, are they willing to make the big sacrifices that would be necessary to really make a dent in the deficit?
No, they would not. That's the central paradox of what we look at in our data. While Americans agree it's a big problem, for example, Americans agree Medicare is a big problem. When you get to the specifics about cutting back spending on almost anything that people value, like Social Security and like Medicare, or even going to a change in Medicare where you have vouchers or give people amounts of money, some of the things that the new VEEP nominee Ryan is talking about, Americans kind of recoil and say, oh, no, don't change that. We like the status quo.
Well, Frank, I mean, you know, there's a big debt clock not far from where I sit right now in New York that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Has the attitude about the debt and the deficit changed over time?
It hasn't changed a lot. It's always been a lurking problem. I mean, you can go back to Ross Perot, who had his third-party candidacy in 1992, got 19% of the popular vote, and of course, one of his central points was that we have this huge deficit we need to do something about, along with trade imbalances. But Americans at that point, of course, didn't elect him president, and it's been lurking in their mind ever since. But it's just hard for us to find evidence in the data that Americans are saying, yes, let's do something dramatic and different at this very moment to try to reduce the deficit.
Well, let me ask you about one more thing before I let you go on a totally different topic, Frank. In 1974, I gather, Gallup asked American women if they would prefer to have a job outside the home or stay home and take care of the family. And at that point, 60% said they would stay home. What is the new data on that?
Aha, we just updated that within the last couple of weeks, and it has flipped, as we would imagine. However, not nearly as much as some people might think. The precise numbers now are 51%, just a bare majority of Americans, women, say that given their druthers, they would work outside the home. 44% say that they would actually want to stay home, and then the rest say they don't have an opinion. So although it's moved in the opposite direction, that's not as dramatic a shift, I think, as some might imagine.
And Frank, this is Jeff Horowitz, and while we've got you here, I'm going to fire a couple more items your way, starting with consumer confidence. Our latest reporting on consumer confidence says it jumped up last month, but the U.S. is a collection of a lot of smaller economies, so when you at Gallup break it down state by state, what do you find?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. We looked at consumer confidence by every state in the union and the District of Columbia for the first 6 months of 2012, aggregating lots of data. The bottom line is, if you want to go where people are upbeat on a relative basis about the economy, go anywhere near the nation's capital, that would be D.C., people who live in the district say, hey, the economy is going very well, plus a bunch of states like Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and Iowa, those states also have very positive people. And then Maryland and Virginia, of course, contiguous to District of Columbia, they too are positive because I guess there's lots of activity in the District of Columbia.
And where are the bummed out people?
Well, it's a interesting conglomeration of states, but the worst is West Virginia, and it's kind of really worse. I mean, people who live in West Virginia are really depressed when we call them up and say, how's the U.S. economy doing? They're significantly below a couple of other southern states, which are 2 and 3, Arkansas and Mississippi. But then there's some states like Wyoming and Montana and Nevada, which are far away from the south, that also have pretty negative people when we ask them about the economy. And then some other southern states, people look pretty dour about the economy as well.
Pivoting to a completely different topic now, conventional wisdom, we all hate the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, with their long lines and their beeping wands and their big machines that scan through our clothing. What's the truth?
Well, there is not a lot of research on that, so we thought we would remedy that. We went out and asked all Americans, and then we separated out frequent flyers and said, all right, what do you think about the Transportation Security Administration? And we were surprised, I have to say, that the attitudes are more positive than, as you said in your introduction there. Mm-hmm. We have among flyers who fly 3 or more times a year, 57% said that, hey, they think the TSA is doing an excellent or good job, and it's a little lower than that among all Americans, but generally the image is quite positive. Where they may fall down, though, at the TSA is effectiveness. Even though we haven't had any significant terrorist attacks on airplanes since 9/11, when we said, well, how effective are they in preventing terrorist attacks, then we have most Americans say, yeah, maybe somewhat effective. But Americans, I don't think it looks like, think that taking off your belt and your shoes and all that necessarily is all that effective in preventing attacks.
Interesting. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Well, while we're talking about the TSA, Jeff, there were some interesting numbers that came out from the TSA's blog.
And
one of them is that they have confiscated 821 firearms so far this year, discovered in carry-on bags at checkpoints all across the United States. That's almost 4 firearms per day. And, you know, in addition to just your standard guns, there were, simulated detonating cord with simulated sheet explosives.
as long as it's just simulated.
Yeah, exactly. We've got training claymore mines, whatever those are, IED training aids.
Warheads.
and a bazooka round, just in case, I guess.
People not quite getting the message about security checkpoints.
Exactly.
Weapons, maybe not so good.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Whether you're talking about Facebook, Google, even Ford, every giant company at one point had to start small. And despite the pros of launching your passion project in places like Silicon Valley or New York City, some new research suggests the best place for a budding business might not be where you think.
Olav Sorensen is a professor at the Yale School of Management. He co-authored the study, and he's with us now for our Midday Extra. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what is the best place to start a new business?
Well, usually it's home, a place where you've lived for a while or that you know well, maybe where you grew up, someplace where you have a lot of connections.
Now, what is it about starting it in, say, your own small town that's somehow better than moving it to a networking hub like Silicon Valley?
Well, I think there's two things that matter. The first is that for a lot of types of businesses, it's important to know something about the local marketplace. So, you know, a tech business is one type of thing, but you could also think about a business like a restaurant or a business service, and having some sense of what the demand is in the community or what people want is valuable there. But for all types of businesses, one of the things that really matters is recruiting. You know, who are those first employees going to be? And when you're local to a community or you know, you're embedded in the social networks, it's much easier for you to find the good people out there who may not be looking for work, but might be the right people to join your startup.
So the idea that you could, you know, fly into Hawaii or something like that and say, they don't seem like they have a great pizza place here. I could come in here and open up a pizza place and business would be great because there's not a business like that. That's a wrong idea, you're saying, because you'd have to know who you were going to hire and all that sort of thing first.
Well, you know, it could work, but it's also possible that there's no pizza place in Hawaii because no one there likes pizza. But even if there is demand for a pizza place, you still also have to know, you know, who am I going to hire? Where do I get suppliers? You know, what's the right place to locate the business, et cetera.
How far into the life cycle of a business does this logic prevail? As your company grows, should you grow it right there at home too? At a certain point, are you big enough that you really should go where the action is?
Well, I think there is a point at which you're sort of big enough that this no longer matters. The research that we were doing really focused on the first 4 or 5 years of a company, and during that whole period, you really benefit from staying at home. But it does seem to decline a little as the companies grow. But there's a flip side to that. It also gets more difficult to move a company once you're looking at coordinating the moves of, you know, 10, 15, maybe 20 different people.
Can you give us an example of a company that's well known that did what you're saying and was able to grow, in its own home and really become a major success story?
Well, I mean, lots of the companies that we think of out there. I mean, Microsoft would be an old example, but one where, you know, Seattle was not considered a tech hub at the time that Microsoft located there and started to build the business. One that's a little bit kind of closer to home for me is Gateway Computers, which started in South Dakota and built quite a business before eventually sort of having a demise. You could look at Dell, right? Dell started out of Michael Dell's basically dorm room and built itself from there. So I think a lot of the examples of successful companies are people that started their business wherever they were embedded in and then got going.
Olaf Sorensen is a professor at the Yale School of Management, co-author of the study we're talking about today. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Jeremy, you remember when every store seemed to be pestering you to sign up for a credit card so that you'd shop there more, right? And it still happens sometimes with the down economy, not so much. But lately, it seems like every store wants you to sign up for their smartphone app. I'm getting that all the time. We've got news this morning on that front that a group of major retailers, including Walmart, Target, and 7-Eleven, are all teaming up to create their own network for mobile payments, which is a pretty powerful group when you start to put them together. One more way for all these stores to draw you closer and to try to get a jump on outsiders who are coming up with their own payment systems like Google. Here again is Marketplace's Heidi Moore.
Steve Ledford, a consultant at the research firm Novantas, is a self-described mobile payments geek. He has a lot of apps designed to make his phone into a virtual debit card.
I have every new payment system that comes along. I try it out.
He's going to have to find more space somewhere. It seems like every company wants in. There's Google Wallet, and Starbucks just signed a deal with Square, so you can buy a latte just by saying your name. Now, 14 retailers, including Walmart and Target, are working on their system, but they have more than mobile payments on their minds.
The ones I like to watch are the folks who are talking about changing the shopping experience.
Ledford says these companies love a captive audience. If you're looking at their app on your phone, you can get little pings to remind you to buy more stuff from them.
If you go on any street or subway or airport lobby, people are always looking at their phones, and so it's not a bad way of getting to folks.
The field is crowded, but there's one company that hasn't done anything yet, Apple. And when they do, that might change everything. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Here in Los Angeles, Jeremy, we've got sun most days of the year, beaches, mountains, palm trees. Am I making you nostalgic / jealous yet?
Good old days.
You lived here. You know about it. One thing we don't have much of anymore, apparently, are one-hour TV dramas. There are 23 new hour-long dramas debuting on the broadcast networks this fall. Only two of those are going to be shot in L.A. County. The rest have departed for other parts of the country. And it's part of a troubling trend for the entertainment business that helps sustain this town. Kevin Clowden is director of the California Center at the Milken Institute, and he co-wrote a new study called Fighting Production Flight. Kevin, great to talk with you.
Pleasure chatting with you.
In the view of your study, what is driving away the TV production from Los Angeles?
Well, there are two things. The first straightforward one is that it's a more expensive location for TV dramas to film in L.A. and or in California in general. than many other places. Costs keep going up for a number of these productions. But the other is there are a lot of different locations around the country now that are not only competing on cost, but also happen to have the staff to actually handle an hour-long television production. A decade ago, it would have been much harder to be able to film a TV show in New Mexico and North Carolina and have the confidence that they'd be able to pull it off over the years.
If LA and California want to remain competitive, is the only choice to join the race to the bottom on tax incentives and so forth?
Yes and no. California actually has a nice incentive package that's worked rather well for the last couple of years in retaining a decent number of film productions and indeed some cable shows. The one catch is there's a big gap in the overall incentive package, and that's hour-long network TV dramas. They're not covered in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, if you talk to a number of different people at the studios or the various producers, they'll say they don't need California to be at the same incentive level you might find in Louisiana or in Georgia. They just need it to be enough lower that they feel like they can match costs instead by the fact that they don't have to worry about the costs that come from maintaining a remote production.
Kevin Clowden directs the California Center at the Milken Institute. Good to talk with you.
Certainly.
Well, different parts of the country have experienced the housing collapse in different ways, but some places have a housing market that seems totally disconnected from the rest of the nation. Places like North Idaho, where these are boom times for housing. And as Jessica Robinson of the Northwest News Network reports, that is thanks in part to people who are drawn to isolation.
Realtor Michael White takes me around a spacious three-bedroom, three-and-a-half-bath home.
Nice wood floors. It's got, you know, nice counter area everywhere.
White points to the airy family room, to the extensive storage space, and then he points up to the wooden hatch in the ceiling that serves as the front door. This house was built entirely underground.
Imagine to yourself a cement pyramid underground with the flat top of the pyramid at ground level.
Shortly after the housing crash, real estate agents here started seeing an unusual type of buyer. They wanted land off the beaten path, preferably defendable. An on-site source of water is a must, plus the potential to go off-grid. Underground bunkers are merely a bonus.
They are well-to-do, they are urban, they're well-educated, they're professionals. They are not down-and-out country bumpkins.
This is Richard Mitchell, a sociologist who studies survivalist culture. He says the recession, combined with a dash of 2012 apocalyptic predictions, have renewed survivalist sentiment.
Institutions have failed us. Therefore, what? Therefore, we should be in a position to take care of ourselves.
And Chris Walsh of Revolutionary Realty says remote and sparsely populated North Idaho is the perfect place for that.
It's just because North Idaho has become America's redoubt. It's a place of refuge.
Walsh says most of his clients are worried about an economic disaster. In fact, he's become a survivalist himself.
I mean, there's some folks out there that think that the whole thing could go down in the next couple of months. I think that it could, too. On the other hand, it could be another 3 years. You know, but the bottom line is, we got a problem.
As for his business, Walsh expects another bump in sales after November. He thinks the presidential election, whichever way it goes, will keep the calls coming in. In Coeur d'Alene, I'm Jessica Robinson for Marketplace.
And now to Hartford, Connecticut, where a lady named Grace Edwards was trying to sell the house she'd lived in for 25 years when a potential buyer asked for a history of her utility charges. That, Jeff, is when she discovered that she's been paying to power two of the streetlights outside her house all these years.
All by herself?
Yeah, that's right. And apparently it was a deal that was made before she bought the house, by the builder, the original builder of the house, according to the Hartford Courant. He made a deal to agree to pay those charges. But, of course, when he sold the house, Grace Edwards and her husband did not make the same deal. And so now, long story short, she has a check from the electric company for $10,491.21.
Wow, something nice happening in Hartford, Connecticut. That's good. As we're talking about cities where people do nice things for you, I don't know if that's a great segue, but in any case, we've got a new list of the best cities to live in the entire world. We love our city lists, and this is kind of the ultimate one, isn't it? This is from the Economist Intelligence Unit. They look at political and social stability, infrastructure, crime, healthcare, education, environmental, cultural life, all that stuff, and they come up with this list. Number one, Melbourne, Australia.
Which
is kind of a repeat victor, I think, in lists of this type. And Australia, in fact, has 4 of the cities in the top 10.
Wow.
Canada has
great weather, beautiful cities.
You know,
easy to get to work.
Canada has 3 of them, though, not known so much for its great weather, but apparently for other things. So that's 7 out of 10 are Australia and Canada. The U.S. does not make the top 10. All the U.S. major cities are buried somewhere in the middle. And down at the bottom, this is where things get a little not so cheery. A massively overcrowded city like Dhaka, Bangladesh, is last, edged out last year's loser, Harare, Zimbabwe. So maybe things looking slightly better in Zimbabwe.
Well, I'm glad I'm not at the bottom of that list. in New York, which I guess is buried somewhere in the middle, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.